Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Rachel Stewart, and this is another presentation for the Sex, Sex Work and Sexualities special series. I'm here today with Christian Grove and John Scott, who are going to talk to us about their book about male sex work. So can you tell us who you are, why this book, and why now?
I'll start with just introducing myself. So I'm Christian Grove. I'm a professor in the Department of Community Health and Social Sciences at the CUNY School of Public Health in New York City.
And I'm John Scott. I'm at the Queensland University of Technology, which is based in Brisbane in Queensland in Australia. And our colleague, who can't be with us this morning, Vic Domenichello, is supposed to be retired, but he keeps himself very busy, and he's an adjunct with the Queensland University of Technology and a couple of other institutions, and he's also based over here in Australia.
So can you tell us why this book, you know, what about the book and why now?
It was started as a bit of a follow-up to an earlier book that we did, Male Sex Work and Society. That earlier book was with a publisher, a small boutique type publisher called Harrington Park Press, and we'd worked with Christian before on with that book. Christian did chapters for it, and we were approached again by the publisher to do a follow up because the first version had been quite successful. That was back in 2014. Seemed like a good time to do a bit of an update, given so much had changed since 2014 around sex work internationally. And there was still a lot of relevant things we thought we had to talk about, you know, particularly issues around the legality of sex work and so on. But also let Christian give his take as well.
I was really excited when Victor and John approached me. As John mentioned, I had contributed a chapter to the prior volume. And so the idea of, you know, being one of the editors on the new book really excited me. And, you know, we sort of thought about it. Well, it's been about 5 years before the next one comes out. Now we're, you know, closer to 7 years, but that's publishing for you. You know, being like, well, a half decade has gone by, you know, what could we say that would be new and different? And what's the kind of feedback that that they received on the first version? And I think, I mean, you can talk about some of the feedback you received. Like, I think there was a greater call for some areas of the globe that were underrepresented in the first book that we made a much more concerted effort to include in this one. And I also think, you know, the goal was to expand into other topics. So it's not just what is sex work like in Europe? What is sex work like in the UK? What is sex work like in Latin America? But also things like how was sex work represented in film, for instance, you know, over time. And John, I'll let you jump in, I think, maybe with the other, you know, like really significant changes that this new volume or this new book entirely, it's not a volume at this point, addresses that the first book that came out in 2014 didn't.
Yes, it's a larger book, I can say that. So we've got, you know, all up about 40 chapters in this one, so it's quite large. One of the things that we really wanted to do, a lot of the work, it's a bit like female sex work, a lot of the work around male sex work is being very epidemiological in scope. So it's it has been, you mentioned earlier, Rachel, about, you know, another conversation about condoms. We're trying to move the conversation slightly away from condoms. There's a little bit about condoms in there. I'm sure there's lots of mentions of condoms throughout the book. But one of the things we wanted to look at was the sort of cultural, historical aspects of sex work as well. You know, the humanities side of, you know, what scholars have been doing around sex work, not just the social sciences, but we're inclusive of the social sciences. Yes, we wanted to go more global in scope, and so we've included, you know, I mean, male sex work, the research is sort of bursting out all over the world at the moment, you know, and there's so much coming from so many different parts of the world and so many different countries. In the past, it was very British, North American focused, the research, at least the English-speaking research, and if you look today, you know, there's research coming out of many, many countries, and we wanted to capture all that, those diverse, rich voices around the male sex industry.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book, because it felt like a kind of almost like a reset to before the debate around trafficking hijacked sex work. And I really enjoyed that kind of cultural studies, use of the image, historical sort of input that I thought, you know, really gave context in ways that you wouldn't necessarily be looking for. I really enjoyed that. So can you talk us through the phrase that you borrow from Weitzer, from Ronald Weitzer, the polymorphous paradigm, and what it means to you in the context of this book?
I think, you know, the polymorphous paradigm, I mean, once again, you know, one of the ideas of the book was to capture the diversity of voices around sex work. I think there's a tendency with us academics, you know, just in the scope, especially us social sciences, scientists, to narrow everything down into types and to, you know, if you like, you know, ideal types around things or to typologies. And you're not going to find a lot of typologizing in this book, you know. Once again, we've really tried to capture the cultural global diversity of sex work. And something that I should have mentioned before I didn't mention, one of the criticisms that we copped in the earlier volume was that we didn't include enough voices of sex workers themselves, you know, sort of current, you know, sex workers. And we've tried to do that in this book. Our plans were a little bit grander in terms of the design of the book. We wanted to have a lot more sex workers included in the book, but that proved difficult for all sorts of reasons in actually, you know, in terms of creating the book. But we did manage to do that in a bigger way than we did previously. So, you know, sort of addressing that point of nothing about us without us, and we thought that was important as well. You know, particularly when it does come to the, you know, the sort of the more current sort of, you know, sort of epidemiological work and that. So again, you know, we wanted to capture that diversity that's out there in terms of our authorship as well.
And John, I think, you know, you reminded me of, you know, one of the chapters that I'm so excited that we were able to include was that on trans male sex workers, you know, written by a, you know, trans male activist, and who also, you know, bears the title of researcher as well. And I think that's the challenge that you face is, you know, finding the intersection between, you know, academic prose and then, you know, activists in the field. But I, you know, there is not a lot written about trans male sex workers, but we've got a whole chapter on it in our book, which I'm thrilled about. So.
Yeah, no, it's good. I liked as well the sort of, the way that you describe in the introduction, the sort of like suggest that people don't think about industry, but think about the sort of diverse communities. So to think about sex work in terms of, you know, a wide variety of sort of communities. And I wondered what are communities that the book covers in terms of, you know, male sex work?
Yeah, well, the community idea was that, I guess, you know, again, going back to that idea about nothing about us without us, I guess that community, it begins with both the sex workers and their clients, you know, and so often clients have, you know, they've been pathologized a bit recently, especially with the politics around sex work. You know, and so once again, we've got people writing from all sorts of perspectives. You know, we've got the, you know, the historic and contemporary voices of clients captured in the book as well. So they're not a group that we're necessarily ignoring here. And we realize that they're important to that whole exchange as well. And you know, yes, once again, they're being pathologized, they're being politicized, you know, in this whole, in these debates around sex work. So we want to hear from them and hear their voices in this book. So you know, they're your basic communities, but I think you'll find that the book captures a lot of communities, you know, global communities and so on.
Do you want to add to that, Christian?
I don't have anything to add. Sorry.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because like we don't hear anything from the customers. I mean, you know, the industry won't run with, I've used word industry, won't use run without them. But we don't talk about them. And then, you know, they're sort of absent, you know, present but absent. But I think as well, the whole idea of like this diverse community, thinking of sex work in terms of diverse communities, really allows us to get away from that notion of an industry and start thinking more in terms of like sexual commerce rather than like an industrial institution. So,
oh, absolutely, yeah. And just put on the matter of clients too. You know, when you look at male sex work historically, it has been the clients who have been you know, pathologized quite a bit more so than when you're looking at female sex work. So you know, if you go back to the earliest research around male sex work, clients were typically characterized as being, you know, inverted commas, homosexual. And they were seen to be highly problematic. You know, they were the ones that were being criminalized, they were the ones that were being policed. And the sex workers, you know, in the earliest days of the research, they were typically, you know, characterized as being victims, you know, people who needed some kind of welfare-oriented help. You know, so I mean, you know, they were copying it in a different way, being pathologized in a different way. So the dynamics around male sex workers is quite a contrast with female sex work, because we know, you know, historically that the clients of female sex workers, while being somewhat pathologized, haven't been to the extent that they have been, you know, with male sex work, and often the clients have been ignored entirely.
And to, you know, sort of build off of the ways in which male clients were pathologized, it's, you know, it was really as predators. You know, on vulnerable, you know, younger men who, you know, who, given their financial circumstances, are being taken advantage of for the purpose, you know, of exchanging sex or converting more people to being gay, you know, through sex work. So I'm very fortunate that we've moved beyond narratives like that, at least.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because in the study of sex work, like female sex work, what I've noticed is this total fetishization of the actual kind of the sex part of the sex worker's life. Okay, so you know that all the focus is on the actual sex work of a sex worker's life, and it's almost like they don't exist outside that sort of like relationship with the customer. But there's no discussion about the customer other than, you know, a source of potential danger. You know, and consequently, we've got this whole new raft of like Nordic model legislation to protect the sex worker from the customer, which hasn't, you know, from a recent study that I've done with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, it's not actually translated into the kind of like the policing of sex workers. It's still sex, the, you know, female sex workers being arrested much more than their male customers. So, but can you tell us how the book discusses the affordances of the web that the web has had for male sex workers? So can you discuss for us how the internet has impacted male sex work?
The affordances. Yeah, look, I think it's a bit like it's a little bit. It's not so dissimilar from female sex work in the sense that the internet's really expanded. I guess the visibility of the industry, in some ways the scope of the industry. Sometimes I use the term of the McDonaldization, you know, sort of the sex industry, and then I think the web's aided that in some ways. And it is connected to that notion of the polymorphous and so on, and just the range of sex work that's available. You know, once again, if I think back to the early studies of sex work, it's typically the clients characterized as an older homosexual male and the sex worker is somebody who's very young, and vulnerable, you know. But if you go online, you know, you see that, you know, there's things are much more diversity and richness out there. So there's a guy that you know, I spoke to recently, who works in Brisbane, and he's almost 50. He's very grey, you know. He's characterised as a bit of a silver fox out there, and he has a particular group of clients, and he tells me that he often feels uncomfortable sometimes because he gets a lot of young clients who want him to be this sort of daddy type, and, you know, and they want to be, you know, sort of disciplined or whatever, you know, and he feels that he's, you know, often sometimes, you know, unfairly pressured by his clients to play into a particular role, and he's very much in demand. He's making a reasonable living off what he does. But it just sort of shows you that there's a lot more out there. There's a lot of diversity out there in the sex industry that the internet has made visible. And there's been a shift, you know, from, forms of work, whether it's parlor work or street work, which was not uncommon with male sex work in the past, more to online type work, so escorting online. So I think that's been a big shift that's happened over the last 10 years or so. But I'll let Christian add to that perhaps.
Yeah, and you know, I think it comes up in multiple chapters in the book. You know, sort of the SOSTA and FESTA, FOSTA and SESTA, sorry, and the shutdown of Rentboy, which, you know, it wasn't the most glamorous website compared to some of its more modern competitors, but that website had been around since the 90s. And a couple of years ago, the Department of Homeland Security, which, why are they involved with sex work, raided Rentboy's offices, which were just down the street from me. I, you know, visited numerous times. They operated on the second floor of a, you know, storefront building, you know, with all of their staff. They sponsored a float at Pride every single year. They had like a very, you know, visible presence, and like every, you know, like they would go into bars and hand out t-shirts, and it's like it was very much a normalized thing for the government to all of a sudden step in and shut them down. I know it comes up a lot in the book because it was one of those, it struck people so strange that this industry that has moved to being online, and dare I would say there are so many benefits to the industry being online in terms of for escorts to have a paperwork trail or, you know, chat trail with their clients compared to getting in someone's car on a street corner, you know, to clients being able to read reviews that have been written by other clients of their escorts to come in and have, you know, shut this down under very, you know, odd circumstances. So, you know, the internet has done so much, and yet there's been, you know, and with Rentboy going down, other websites, you know, sort of fell with it. There was Hook U, and John, I don't know if you were familiar with Hook University.
No.
Not at all. Hook U was an initiative to connect escorts together for like, how do we become better escorts? So they offered a series of workshops to anyone that's interested in attending them for things like setting up your profile, screening your clients, what to do with the income, how do you file your taxes when you don't have a job, you know, and you know, what are acceptable deductions and unacceptable deductions from your taxes, and of course, like things like how do you exit the industry, you know, how do you know when the time is right for you, and how do you exit the industry and parlor the skills that you attained while being an escort onto a resume to get a job, you know, somewhere else. So, sorry, bit of a side thing on there, but you know, I think that's some of the shifts that we've seen in the internet as well. And I think other things that have changed so much in sex, which has bled into sex work, is you know, when the 2014 book came out, PrEP was barely a, you know, sort of a thing that exists. Now here we are, it's 2021. It's, you know, almost a decade that we've had PrEP in existence. It's really reframed sex, and it's reframed as a result, I think, sex work as well. So you see that represented in the book too. It's no longer about condoms.
Yeah. So I've, like, you know, I mentioned earlier when I was involved with the research with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and we interviewed like sort of across London, you know, a lot of different sex workers. And what we found is that the male sex workers tended to use apps a lot more than women. In fact, women weren't using apps at all, whereas the male sex workers were using all different types of apps to sort of like meet each other. They were kind of almost, they'd already sort of swerved this sort of block that had been put on, you know, by Foster Sesta. you know, they'd already kind of like started to negotiate. In fact, they were working quite markedly different ways to female sex workers. So in your book, how does male sex work, you know, sort of differ from female sex work, would you say?
Can I jump in first on this one, John? So I think one thing that you know happens with male sex work that doesn't happen with female sex work is that male sex workers are in the same hookup apps that other gay and bisexual men are using to meet up. So it's almost expected and to, you know, some extent accepted that in the space that you're trying to meet people, you're also going to encounter people that might be looking to buy or sell. And that's completely, you know, acceptable. I don't know to what extent female sex workers are on OkCupid and Tinder. I'm going anecdotally, but I sort of imagine in this, you know, or Christian Mingle, they're probably not on there either. but, you know, it's whereas, you know, with apps, it's like it's sort of hand in hand that, you know, that those individuals exist in this environment. And, you know, as long as if there's no harassment going on one way or the other, it's, you know, even though it might be against the terms of service, you're probably not going to be turned in by the user base for doing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I think the other thing too is that I guess the male sex work is scaffolded, if you like, by other types of communities. So these external communities. So you know, it might be subgroups within, you know, the wider, you know, queer culture that, you know, facilitates some of this. And that seems to be what Christian's inferring to there as well. I think that there tends to be a lot more and you know, and I don't mean this in a negative way about female sex work, but male sex workers tend to be, in inverted commas, you know, relatively more independent in how they operate and how they work. And that's been observed in quite a lot of the research. So although, you know, I've mentioned this sort of community link, this seems to be a strong sort of independence. You know, they don't often contact other male sex workers or talk to other male sex workers. They're less inclined to get involved in online chats among male sex workers, for example, swap advice with each other. Although in Australia, in the country I'm based in, there are, Christian mentioned Hook University before, there are groups here, advocacy groups in Australia that are often sponsored by the state or partially funded by the state, who will go out and do sort of similar type training, offer similar types of advice, workshops, things, work in advocacy for female and male sex workers. And often male sex workers are represented by those groups, not to the same extent that female sex workers are, but those groups, my local one in Queensland is called Respect Inc. And you can look them up online and you'll find them. And there's a couple of guys that work with Respect Inc. And Respect Inc. at the moment, they're out there advocating for the decriminalisation of sex work in this state. But they do also offer workshops and other things for male sex workers, which I understand are taken up occasionally by the men.
It's quite interesting that you mentioned that male sex work seems to be the sort of like there's a bit of a porous sort of barrier between sex work and socialization, and that lack of kind of more identifiable sort of like sex work support. And I wonder what you think, if that's a consequence of the lack of like sort of feminist campaigning against sort of like female sex work hasn't happened with male sex work. So it's almost like sort of male sex workers haven't been sort of like removed from the society in the same way as female sex work has been, as a consequence of like all this feminist, you know, sort of radical feminist sort of campaigning against sex work. There just hasn't been that level of campaigning, has there? So
I would agree with that statement. I would also throw out there, I don't know how to what extent this is very well represented in the book, only because it's so new and emerging. But in terms of like, you know, where are we headed with all of this? There often was a pathway between appearing in adult films and then becoming a sex worker. You know, appearing in the film once is going to get you a few hundred dollars, but then when you can advertise yourself as having appeared in the film, you know, that's where you can really rake in the money. And these days, you know, we're seeing the emergence of, I'll call it the Uberfication of sex work, of, you know, people setting up their OnlyFans page and, you know, just for fans, and then cross using Twitter as a social platform to promote, you know, them both as a, you know, watch me have sex and pay a monthly subscription for that, but also potentially as a, and for a certain price, you can hire me, you know, for this or pay me to perform various acts. And I'll speak anecdotally at this point, but it feels like everyone has an OnlyFans page these days. It's like LinkedIn for gay people, which I think is wonderful. It's, I find it very sex positive, and I'm glad that everyone's doing it. I almost feel left out because I was like, God, I feel like, you know, this, everyone has to have one of these days. A little off topic, but I really think that as we talk about the normalization of sex work, you know, it's sort of almost expected. If you're sharing your Twitter handle, you're probably going to have X-rated content on it, unless you're doing it, you know, for pure professional reasons.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. I mean, the only people that seem to use Twitter are sex workers and academics. Perfect meeting place. But do you think as well, there's like when I did my research with webcam performers, what I found is that there was this real kind of crossover where people would do porn as a sort of loss leader that kind of advertised their webcam sort of presence, and the webcam presence actually did boost their porn career, although they weren't making significant money off their porn. Have you seen that type of crossover with male sex workers at all?
Well, yeah, I think it's fairly common. Yeah. But I was going to say before, Christian, you know, it's hard being an academic. I don't think we can do OnlyFans. I mean, at least here in Australia, it'd be quite scandalous. I mean, doing interviews on your book is about the closest thing we get to that kind of celebrity, which is fortunate, you know. You'll be that we get to do that stuff fully clothed, and there's no physical requirements of us whatsoever around anything.
Thank goodness.
So we sort of mentioned the Nordic model sort of briefly earlier on. Can you describe the impact that the Nordic model is having on male sex work?
Can you say that again? Sorry.
So we sort of mentioned earlier on the Nordic model. I wonder if you could describe the impact that the Nordic model of legislation is having on male sex work.
Look, I think it's often, you know, male sex work is caught up with female sex work in one way or another. And the, you know, the legislation that operates in any jurisdiction does often, you know, include male sex workers as well as female sex workers. So if it's illegal in places, it's going to mean that, you know, male sex work is illegal. Male sex work does have the additional issue that in some places where same-sex desire and contact is criminalised, you've got that added layer of criminal law around it. But I guess that there's been less incentive to go out and prosecute male sex workers, especially now that, you know, much of it's online, a lot of escorts. I know Christian mentioned earlier the issue around Rent Boy, and that was, you know, that was a big case, but it was less prosecuting the male sex workers rather than the platforms from where they operated. And I think, you know, the people operating those platforms do have to navigate the law and navigate it very, very carefully in their respective jurisdictions. But in a place like Australia, there isn't a lot of prosecutions of male sex workers, so it tends to be fairly rare. Additionally, you know, I don't think there's a lot happening around female sex work, so the Nordic model hasn't had a lot of impact here, and this is where Christian's going to come in and perhaps talk about the North American experience. But, you know, people may not be aware that in Australia we've got a number of states, and the sex industry was decriminalised in New South Wales, which was the first state anywhere in the world to decriminalise the sex industry, the first jurisdiction. And that means that police don't actually run sex work. You know, they don't have anything to do with sex work. The sex industry is treated like a regular business. And you know, that's great. And that was way back in 1995. And they've had inquiries around decriminalisation since, and they show that the health of sex workers is better, their safety is better, the safety of clients is better. You know, so by any measure, it's a bit like climate science. By any measure, it's shown that decriminalisation is true, it's effective, it works. You know, you can do all these studies on it and they keep coming up with the same thing, that it's been very effective. Does that mean that it gets adopted? Does it mean that it gets taken up everywhere else? No, it doesn't, of course not. So the only other places in the world, I think, is a territory of Australia where it's decriminalised, and then there's the nation of New Zealand where it's decriminalised. And similarly, in those places, the benefits of decriminalisation have been found to be very positive, very effective. So it's interesting. So in the Antipodes down here, the Nordic sort of debate has had, you know, relatively much less impact than it has in the Northern Hemisphere. So, and that's probably a good cue for Christian to talk about the American experience.
It's a mess here. As our listeners at home probably know, you know, there are some places in the United States where, you know, sex work is permitted and completely regulated. While you were talking, I was just Googling on my phone because there's been a lot of chatter about what's going on in New York specifically, where there finally is some momentum to, you know, to do more to protect sex workers and to, you know, legalize or otherwise decriminalize the industry. But we remain so far behind. Other countries from the Nordic model, you know, for instance. And if you've paid attention to any politics in the United States, things are a little messy here and take a long, you know, time. And it seems like much of the initiative is often coming at the state level and the local municipality level, as opposed to Congress, you know, being able to act, you know, to pass something. And if anything, they're passing things to make it more difficult rather than, you know, to make things better for sex workers. So we'll see. And, you know, and I'll use the example of marijuana legalization and decriminalization, which is very, it's happened with same-sex marriage too, is you had a couple of states, you know, in which it, you know, became legal, and then all of a sudden other states are jumping on board. So, you know, perhaps if New York does take more bold moves to, you know, decriminalize or legalize sex work, we'll start to see other states adopt that model as well, in spite of, you know, the federal level being able to act in such a way that would decriminalize. I have no faith that Congress would take action to do it, but I do have faith that, you know, certain states, you know, would make bold moves, and then neighboring states would adopt the model once they see that the world didn't end when we allowed sex work to happen.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because like the whole sort of Nordic model debate is really coming on the coattails of the whole trafficking kind of moral panic. That doesn't seem to have happened around male sex work in the same way that it's been attached to female sex work. And I wondered, you know, like nobody really wants to get into a debate about trafficking, because obviously that's just like totally sort of suffocated any debates about sex work since 2000 and the well-known Paloma Protocol. Let's not go there yet. But it's kind of like, it's interesting that that hasn't been attached at all to like male sex work. I mean, the whole trafficking. I mean, is there literature out there about trafficking and male sex work? I don't think so. I've not read it.
There's little bits and pieces that you can find, but look, there's not a detailed literature, and I think one of the reasons for that is the moral entrepreneurs haven't been out there sort of advocating that we need to sort of, you know more about, you know, the instances of male sex trafficking. There hasn't been that sort of advocacy around it to the extent that there has been in regards to to women. And therefore, you know, there hasn't been the level of funding that you found everywhere else to look at, you know, sort of female related sex trafficking. I mean, something that I try to hive off, you know, separate out is the fact that, you know, as the title of our book suggests, we're looking at sex work. And so we're calling it work. And, you know, and it's something that we see as, you know, typically, you know, not always, you know, but it's like all work, you know, not always, but, you know, mostly involving consenting, rational adults.
Yeah.
And, you know, who have actually agency and have made a choice to engage in that type of behaviour. That doesn't mean there's going to be instances in which there is exploitation and, you know, whatever else. But as we know from the New South Wales experience where it's decriminalised, you know, there are still laws criminalising, you know, laws that apply to any business, you know, exploitative forms of behaviour, you know. And so that's something, trafficking for me is something very, very different, you know. It's about, you know, the use of force and, you know, and exploitation. Yes, it should be criminalised, but, you know, that's not something I'm an expert on, and it's not something I feel that I can really comment on in any depth, because what I'm interested in looking at is this thing called sex work, which is something entirely different.
Yeah. And that's what I really enjoyed about the book, is that you've put aside these kind of like these done to death sort of debates around sort of victimization and trafficking. And you've looked at sex work as a sort of multifaceted social experience. So there's, you know, I wondered if you could kind of like talk us through the different sections of the book and what areas you cover.
Sure.
And why you chose those.
No, I'll turn it over to you, John.
Yeah, look, as mentioned earlier, look, we sort of start the book by we really tap into the humanities, you know. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of research around sex work has been social science oriented, and, you know, and it was becoming a little bit dry around the condom use, you know, and the sexual health kind of stuff and the head counting and everything else. So, you know, I think the first part of the book's really fun because, you know, we look at fashion and male sex work, you know, like we look at the cinema, you know, we look at, you know, historical instances of male sex work. We look at, you know, famous people from history and their historical diaries as clients, you know, being involved with male sex workers, you know. So it's material that you don't see a lot in terms of, you know, just regular academic publications, journal publications. It often gets buried underneath all this sort of all this measurement stuff, if you like. And so it's this really rich qualitative work that's been done, you know. And so we take a very cultural take on male sex work and try to shift out of that sort of, I guess, that pathological type space. That doesn't mean that we throw out the social science stuff completely. So we have looked at, you know, the health of male sex workers, you know, physical, psychological, and other parts of the book. We have attempted to sort of, you know, enumerate aspects of male sex work globally. So we've done a little bit of that. But I guess the other main part of the book is dealing with globalisation and just the diversity, you know, of masculinities, you know. And one of the big frameworks that we've tapped into theoretically is all that research has happened over the last 20, 30 years on masculinities. And, you know, so we're all our authors, we draw on that extensively throughout the book to try to frame the experience of these communities that exist around male sex work, you know, both the clients and the sex workers. And one of the things that we really do highlight is that because of these varied global frameworks for masculinities, the experience of male sex work all over the world can be quite distinct and quite different. And just the last point, you know, and I've spoken a bit here, but I one of my other side projects recently has been around a thing called called Southern Criminology. So, and, you know, done a book on that recently, and that book taps into Raewyn Connell's Southern Theory, you know, where Raewyn talks about how, you know, the global north is basically used, the global south as a bit of a data mine, and, you know, go down research, put your frameworks over it as kind of blueprints to understand everything. So I guess one of the things that the book's trying to do is, you know, break with that sort of tradition and capture these you know, if you like, southern voices around male sex work, and not frame those voices in a very sort of, I guess, you know, be it a social scientific way, be it a quantitative way, be it, if you like, a northern way, but let them speak for themselves, and you know, develop their own understandings around the phenomenon that's occurring in those very countries that we look at.
And I would just add, I think the geographical representation in this book, I think, is pretty darn awesome. You know, the chapters on the United States, Canada, is it Brazil specifically, I believe, the Caribbean. We ended up getting a chapter on the Middle East, correct? A lot of what is known on sex work is based in Europe, Australia, and the United States, you know, for the most part, and Canada. So I think the fact that we were able to include representation of regions that have really just been not part of the lexicon or the canon on male sex work, I think is a very strong appeal for this book, in addition to the fact that we're moving outside of the social sciences and, you know, looking at sex work as it represented in film and literature, and historically. So,
It helps to break that kind of epistemic like exploitation thing, doesn't it? If you allow at least, you know, sort of like an inside of you to actually say what's going on where people live, but also as well, it allows you to broaden the what we consider to be sex work beyond, you know, that direct paid for sex act. That I think we, you know, that in the global Northwest, we've got a very narrow view of what sex work actually involves. And I think, sort of, you know, this book enables the reader to kind of, increase their understanding of what is involved in sex work.
Yeah. And also, I guess, to go back to the Nordic model that you mentioned earlier, I guess it discourages blanket essentialist type characterizations of sex work. So we're trying to get away from that. This idea that there's some model that's going to fit everything globally, or there's some sort of framework for understanding, sex work or even sexual exploitation, that's just going to be this thing that you can throw over everything and understand it. Rather, what we're saying is that you've really got to get down to the cultural dynamics, you know, and masculinity is important to understand, as I've already mentioned, you know, does masculinity involve power relationships? Yes, of course it does, you know, it obviously does, but we're not denying that power exists out there, that exploitation and so on exists out there, but what we're saying is that to get a better appreciation of the phenomenon, something like male sex work and its complexity, that you do need to drill down into specific cultural contexts. And, you know, and you can't just, you know, go out and, you know, apply this, you know, whatever it might be, Nordic model or anything else, to everything.
Okay, so there's sort of like one, I've focused in this presentation around the work that you've actually written. So, I've kind of concentrated on your introduction, your conclusion. But you write a really interesting chapter 16, about quantifying male sex work. And can you talk me through some of the issues that you would have naturally been confronted by trying to quantify something as unquantifiable as people sort of like engaged in sexual commerce?
So that was a chapter that Victor led up the effort for. And he is the perfect person, I think, to answer that question more specifically. John, I don't know if you have much to add other than that.
Oh, look, yeah, because I've had discussions with Victor around these issues in the past. But I mean, one of the things on that is that we are aware that, I mean, one of the, there's various ways. It's a problem that we don't know how many male sex workers. I think there's a gap, as Victor will argue, you know, in terms of understanding. How can you talk about a phenomenon if you can't say how many there are out there, you know? So theoretically, there could be no male sex workers in the world today. Now, I know that sounds stupid, but, you know, look, it could be possible. How do we know that they exist? How do we know how many are out there? And how do we know, I guess, regional geographic variability, how it operates? Does it, you know, is it the case that in a country where it's illegal, where homosexuality is illegal, do you have less male sex workers? So these things are important questions, you know, that we should have some sort of a grasp on, you know, if we're going to go out and advocate for policy change around something like decriminalisation. So I think that's what Victor would probably say around this. And Victor and I have tried to quantify it in the past, and we've done this by looking at instances of advertising from escorts, internet escorts online. But, of course, the problem with this is that, you know, you can put up an ad to advertise your services, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're actually going to provide any service to anybody, you know. So you can advertise all you like, but you may not actually be providing any services. Does that matter? Are we interested just in how many people are out there, you know, trying to advertise, trying to sell sex, or are we interested in people that are actually selling it? Are we interested in people that are working, you know, selling sex for 10 hours a week, 40 hours, you know, 50 hours is a full there to be a full-time job, a casual job? We know, we think we know that, you know, a lot of male sex workers tend to work, you know, fairly casually. So they won't often have it as a full-time job. So the person, my friend that I mentioned earlier who works in the industry in Brisbane, the mature guy, he works full-time in another occupation, you know, so in a physical kind of labouring occupation. And he will just do this type of work. He might do it, you know, a few jobs a week, and that's the extent of it. So it's a very casual kind of thing for him. Does that mean he counts as a male sex worker? Well, in my opinion, yes, he does. But you know, you can see where, you know, people might want to debate these sorts of things, you know. And so it does get really tricky on this counting process. What's included and what isn't included. At what point do you become a male sex worker? I know this sounds very deep, and at what point do you stop being one? To be a male sex worker, do you have to be currently engaged in the industry, or does it count if you were historically engaged? So there's all sorts of issues around the counting, you know, and also around male sex workers. Christian intimated earlier too. There's a lot of stuff that goes on quite variable sites, you know. So you might go into something like Grindr, and you know, you have a date, you're not expecting it to be a male sex work encounter as a client, you don't intend it to be, but somebody asks you for money, or you know, or maybe it's somebody says, you know, let's go out for dinner, and then they hit you up for the bill, you know, like does that mean, and you're willing to pay for it, does that mean that, you know, you just had a romantic date, or have you just engaged in some kind of form of exchange that wasn't, you know, directly for money, you know, and that's, look, it's totally not uncommon. It could be that there's drugs involved in the exchange and all sorts of things. So it's really tricky.
So what was it you were hoping to achieve with this book when you three wrote it?
We certainly weren't expecting to get rich off it or anything, despite the earlier book having done reasonably well. The broader political aim with it was to advocate around decriminalisation of the sex industry, you know, and of course, as we were inferring before, I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, you just decriminalise it for men and not women, you know, so we're talking about the sex industry more broadly. As I suggested, decriminalisation does seem to, you know, inverted commas, work, and so one of the objectives of the book was to extend the work that we did earlier, include more voices within the sex industry in that book, because we thought that was a shortcoming of the earlier book. We did have a few voices, but I think we've got, you know, a lot more in this volume, and basically to pick up where we left off last time, and that was extending the story a little bit more. I mean, like in the last book, we had a couple of historical chapters. We started to touch on a little bit of the cultural stuff. But to be honest, you know, and a little bit of the global stuff, but to be honest, a lot of it just wasn't that advanced. And then, wow, in the last 5 or 6 years, there's just been this outgrowth of really diverse research that, I think as Christian said earlier, that was probably only made possible by the advent of things like PrEP and so on, where basically, you know, you could turn away from that epidemiological side of things and focus more on these other aspects of sex work. You know, I think, you know, one day when the sex industry is decriminalised all over the world, we'll be asking questions, you know, not about how many people use condoms, but it'll be about, you know, how do you be a successful, how do you run a successful escort business, or how do you be, you know, a successful escort or an ethical, how do you run an ethical business? So we'll be looking at all these other questions that we never asked before, that looks more at the, if you like, the professionalization of sex work, and processes of professionalization. So I think they'll be the sorts of questions that we'll be asking increasingly more into the future, and looking at those questions in very diverse contexts. Will there be, you know, exploitation in any criminalised sex work world? Yeah, there will be. And so we'll still have to account for that. And there'll be a lot of that going on, just because there's, you know, a lot of, you know, power relationships exist everywhere, you know, between individuals, between different regions. And so there'll still be a lot of what we were aiming for with the book, actually, was the question.
Yeah. What do you hope to achieve with this volume?
Yeah. So look, I guess on a wider level, we were advocating for decriminalisation, as we mentioned earlier. We felt that the earlier book probably hadn't done that enough. Certainly it was a highlight of the earlier book, but we wanted to be a little bit more explicit in this book. Once again, we wanted to capture the growth of research around male sex work that wasn't just that epidemiological work that's, you know, really expanded over the last decade and moved into areas such as the humanities. We wanted to create what might be the initial sort of scaffolding for a more global understanding of male sex work, and we think the time's right for that. So I guess the book had some sort of political aims. We certainly want to capture more sex worker voices and a greater diversity of voices in the male sex work communities that we spoke about earlier. So basically a lot of it was to extend the work that we'd started in that first volume and to make it more explicit than what it had previously been.
Where do you see new avenues of research going?
Sorry?
Where do you see new avenues of research going?
Yeah. Okay, so new avenues of research. Yeah, look, I'm hoping that that we can talk about and we can think about the sex industry in the future, not just in terms of, you know, head counting and measuring, you know, condom use and not look at it just as a health problem, but also look at this whole growth of professionalisation of the sex industry, the professionalisation of male sex work. As we move to less regulated environments, I think the issue becomes, you know, just like any other business, you know, how do businesses professionalise? What makes for a more effective business? What makes for an ethical business? Will there still be instances of exploitation involving male sex work in a decriminalised world? Yes, of course there will be. You know, power exists everywhere. It exists in relationships, you know, micro relationships, if you like, between individuals. And on a small intimate level, but it also exists regionally, you know, where, you know, you've got things like sex tourism and other stuff. And you know, in a globalising world, you know, we're very aware of those power relationships. But that shouldn't prevent us from also looking at the other side of the picture, and that is the increasing professionalisation of, sex work. And what does that mean for both clients and sex workers themselves? And what does it mean in terms of how we regulate the sex industry or sex industries going forward?
I mean, there's a whole conversation to be had about the impact of the sort of like neoliberalism on sex work, you know?
Yeah, absolutely there is.
My own research is like based around sort of like this neoliberal form of sex work that couldn't exist without the internet, and it's had a massive impact on the way sex work is conducted. So it'd be really interesting to sort of like, you know, sort of like to explore fields like, you know, male sex work in a sort of neoliberal context. You know, the field is just so open. It's so open.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, your work is brilliant because it kind of it opens up a lot of different areas to discuss, like, you know, the social image aspect, you know, the social media aspect, the history. There's, you know, you've set the reader on quite a few different potential paths of research if they were interested. So who do you see as your audience? Who is this book written for?
Good question. Unfortunately, it's probably mostly going to be academics who are going to read it. The book, as much as we try, it will not make everybody happy, you know. So there'll be people who think that the industry should be more criminalised, more regulated, who aren't going to be happy with what we say, who perhaps think that males shouldn't be much of a focus. You know, because they make up, you know, well, typically about 10% of the overall global, you know, sort of sex worker community. So, and there'll be sex workers themselves will be unhappy with it and say, well, this book doesn't really speak to my experiences and, you know, my understanding of what I do. And look, you know, we're ready for that. We think it would have been impossible to write something without, you know, putting some people offside. You know, we can't capture every aspect of the experience of the sex industry. So, but in terms of who we think our audience will be at the end of the day, look, I kind of hope it'll be people who have a particular view of the sex industry and perhaps want to be challenged, you know, perhaps want to learn more about the sex industry. So I think it could be a useful text for people who know relatively little about the sex industry, have a particular view of it, whether it be a sensationalized view, whether it be a biased view. And in that sense, you know, the book might be, you know, hopefully educational. I mean, at the end of the day, we're academics, so, you know, it's an academic book. There won't be a lot of titillation in it. I know sex sells, but as an academic, sex doesn't really sell that much, really. It tends to be something that, you know, my experience is that when you sort of write books in these areas or you have classes and that, if it's in the academic sphere, people tend to back away. So, you know, it doesn't sell in a big way, I guess. But I just wanted to touch on, you mentioned earlier about the neoliberal stuff too. I mean, and that's another, you know, avenue for research as well. I mean, neoliberal means different things to different people. But I've been doing a little bit of research work recently with Jane Schooler from over there in the UK, and we're trying to write an article up on neoliberalism and the sex industry at the moment. And my take is that decriminalisation is actually quite neoliberal, you know. So we tend to think of all things neoliberal as being really bad, you know, or really negative. But I'm certainly an advocate for decriminalisation, and I believe, you know, you could characterise it in many ways as being neoliberal, and we're trying to sort of think through this proposition. And you know, why the sex industry has been decriminalised in some places and not others, by looking at it through this kind of neoliberal framework. So, I mean, that's another avenue for potential research going forward. And I think, you know, we could look a lot more at that question of the impacts of neoliberalism on the sex industry. And I don't see neoliberalism as something that's essentially good or bad. So, I think it can have different effects and different impacts on different industries. And in the case of decriminalising something, you know, maybe it's not a bad impact.
I think it's quite interesting in terms of neoliberalism to see what has been legislated and what doesn't get legislated. So I'm really, like, you know, like I've mentioned before, my study is webcamming. And even in places like America that are insane when it comes to the legislation around sex work, webcamming is entirely legal. It's entirely legal. Even the foster incestor thing doesn't touch it. You know, it doesn't touch it, because, and I don't know if it's a case of, like, you know, the radical feminist can take on a millionaire that owns, you know, sort of Backpage, but it's not up for a billionaire that owns a hosting site, or the fact that every single transaction goes through the banking system virtually. But there's a whole different discussion about, you know, it's almost like at the moment, the criminalization of some forms of sex work distracts from the total lack of legislation about other forms of sex work. You know, and I think that's the interesting sort of, like, conversation to have. And, you know, sort of, like, you know, I wonder how that touches, like, male sex work. I mean, you know, my research around webcamming, like, I think I interviewed 35 women. They were hooking up with their punters online. Yeah. So, they you know, the webcam has become like the new street. And, you know, I wondered if that's the same with male sex work, and whether you thought about investigating that avenue, you know. Where are the new streets? If we're not on the street, you know, the street has a function, so where is the street now, you know? And I find that quite interesting, because I think we need to sort of, like, have a think about sort of the legislation that we talk about and that is most kind of punitive and abolitionist tends to be attached to the types of sex work that are pre, you know, sort of, like, sort of industrial, they're industrialized forms of sex work. Yeah. So those are the ones that that are sort of legislated, and the things that aren't legislated is, you know, the stuff that's afterwards. It's almost like you can't turn around and sort of undo 160 years worth of feminist debate saying that, you know, all forms of sex work is exploitative, but, you know, just offside, just on this webcam, it's going to be business as usual. And the banks go along with it. So yeah, I think it's this. So, you know, I loved this book. I really enjoyed reading it. It kind of gave me loads to think about, that whole Southern sort of aspect of it, made it so much more interesting. And I think you've done a really, really good job, you know, and I would, you know, I could see that being like a go-to text, you know, in universities that are running sort of sex work modules. This is amazing. It's like, you know, I gained so much from it, and I've consistently gained a lot from you guys' work, which is why I wanted to talk to you about your work, because I think what you're doing is groundbreaking. You're sort of pushing the conversation away from victimization and looking at sexual commerce as a rational way of generating an income, you know. And I, you know, I really appreciated the book and the work that you guys have done. So for the people listening, we did have some mad weather conditions here in sunny Margate in England. So we did drop out. We lost Christian, but we've still got John. And so, John, tell it, you know, what's the name of the book and who's it published by?
Yeah. So the book, it's a handbook. It's a Routledge handbook. Male Sex Work, Culture and Society. Is the name of it. It is published by Routledge and by Routledge London, I might add, although they've got, you know, outlets all over the world. And just mentioning the publisher, there's a bit of a backstory to it too. When we initially started this book, which was several years ago now, we were approached by a guy called Bill Cohen in New York, who was the publisher of the original volume. So Bill was a publisher of Hayworth Press, which was a gay press, and it was, you know, he'd sold it off and sort of retired, but he kept an imprint called Harrington Park Press. And he'd been a wonderful publisher. I mean, this guy was just a luminary in the industry and really pioneered queer publishing, you know, over decades, many decades, going back to the 1970s. And we'd loved working with Bill. It had been great fun, the first book working with him. He really went out of his way. He was quite a wealthy man, having sold off his earlier press. And this was like a bit of a hobby for him, you know, and he was politically active around these issues as well, you know, so it was something that he's very passionate about. And so, you know, just before the epidemic began, we found out that Bill had actually passed away in New York. So this was tragic, because we turned in the whole book and he'd begun copy editing, you know, so we were ready to publish about 18 months ago. Bill died, the press got sold, and they basically ceased to function, you know, because it's not easy selling a, you know, boutique press that runs at a loss. It's really there for political activism and sort of purposes. And so the press closed shop. And we were suddenly thinking, oh God, do we go forward? Do we keep working on this? What are the legal issues? And so it was just a real nightmare for a while. And this is in the midst of lockdown and a pandemic. But fortunately, we thought we'll try Routledge, and they had the handbook series, and it was quite a big volume. We had 40 chapters already, so we were just very fortunate to get this published at the end of the day. And it's amazing that, you know, going back, that 1 year later after this happened, we're about to see it in print. So this has really been a saga, you know, because you can imagine all the contractual stuff that going through with 40 chapters, some of them with six authors, and it's been absolutely horrendous. So it was like doing the whole book over again. So like, I feel like I've done it twice. As much as I love producing the book, I have to say I'm going to be very happy to see it published, and very, very relieved to see it published at last. So it's been quite a saga for us. So that's just a little bit of a backstory, which may not be of that much interest to your listeners, but you just reminded me of it with your last question.
Oh no, I'm sure they're interested. So so can you name like yourself and the other author so people know who
yes.
you are?
Yep. Yeah, okay. So, look, I'm John Scott, so let's call me John Jeffrey Scott, which is my middle name added as well, because there is a John Scott over there in the UK who's now retired, but lovely bloke, but a sociologist, and sometimes in the past I've gotten his emails and vice versa. And then we've got Christian Grove, who's based in the US, City of New York University. Finally, we've got Victor Minichello, who is he's now retired, but look, he keeps so busy, and he's got a few gigs with different universities, including Queensland University of Technology, where I work. We've all published previously around male sex work. In fact, Victor goes back decades. He's really one of the pioneers of this area. So he was publishing on this area and looking at the professionalisation of male sex work as far back as the late 1980s, you know. So Victor's research really has got this magnificent pedigree behind it as well, and I've been very fortunate to work with him, as I have with Christian in the past as well. So, yeah, so it's been fun with those guys. Who knows, we might have other projects. Hey, in 10 years' time, we might be looking at the next volume, you know. So and who knows where things are going to be at in 10 years' time in a decriminalised world of sex work. Who knows what we're going to be talking about?
It can happen. It has happened before, you know. The majority of like history, we were not criminalized. So yeah. thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much. This has been an excellent podcast. I've really enjoyed doing this with you, and it's a superb book.